From Mississippi to Wyoming, Virginia to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Oklahoma has made great strides in providing parents and students with education options. Among those, a return to classical education focused on the roots of our nation's founding. Oklahoma State Superintendent Ryan Walters is here with details. States across the country continue to hold their primary elections. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on congressional election results in last week's Georgia primary. President Biden has jawboned private businesses over what he calls junk fees, but Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Nick Anthony of the Cato Institute report on government junk fees the president can actually control. And once again, the alarm has been raised over the pending insolvency of the Social Security Trust Fund. Colin Hanna has an American Radio Journal commentary on how to fix the problem. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A classical education, giving K-12 students an understanding of Western civilization, is among the expanding range of school choice options available in Oklahoma. Here to talk about the progress the state has made in giving parents and students more choices is Ryan Walters. He is the Oklahoma State Superintendent. Ryan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ryan, you talk a lot about a classical education, and we're talking about K-12 students here. What do you mean by that term?
Classical education is something that's been around in the country for a long time. It was how the founders went to their education process through their schools. And it is an understanding that you start with grammar, and that means obviously grammar in English, but it also means just starting with the facts. You have to understand a baseline level of facts, whether it's math, reading, science, history. You then move on into logic, which is then where you start to understand how the facts interconnect with each other. You start doing some thinking around those essential facts. Then you move on into rhetoric, which is the ability to either write or make a verbal argument around facts using logic. And so when you build all this into an education system, you get back to the basics by focusing on facts, making sure students understand those facts and how they interconnect, and then you actually make arguments, and it is crazy for 2024, right? You actually got to make arguments that use the facts and actually have linear logic as the baseline for the arguments you're making. So when you do this, you really woke-proof education by forcing education to be about those essential facts and making sure that it's actually true.
You talk in a recent op-ed that you co-authored about the fact that this classical education here, Ryan, goes way back in history, all the way back to Athens and Jerusalem, and talks about the great philosophers of Europe that all informed the founding of the American Republic. How important is it for students today to learn all this? Is it still relevant?
Absolutely. I believe it's essential for the future of this country. I believe we are experiencing an existential threat right now as a society when it comes to we don't understand our history. We don't understand the values this country was founded on. We reject basic truth. And when you do that to a society, that society at some point will no longer exist. We've seen that through the lessons of history. And it is essential that our young people not only understand our country's history, but they understand Western civilization history and understand what made a difference in our part of the world to make us this exceptional country. Well, it was the understanding that our founders had of history. And our kids have to know that. And we're not going to continue to be this incredible country if we forget who we are, we forget what made us great, and we forget where those ideals came from. Because ultimately what you have today is radical leftists who are set on drastically reshaping this country in a Marxist worldview. And so they start with an understanding that kids have to be ignorant and you got to teach them things that frankly aren't true. You have to lie to kids and indoctrinate kids. So it's essential that we build up that baseline of knowledge, and we do it through classical learning.
There's a lot of talk on the left these days about defending democracy. But in your experience, have you found that the folks who are out there, quote, defending democracy are the ones who are opposing such a classical education?
Yeah, they are complete liars in the way that they describe this. It is a lie. They are the ones that are doing all they can to destroy this constitutional republic. They are trying to imprison a presidential candidate right now. They are weaponizing the justice system. They are trying to take our history out of our textbooks by saying that America is an evil, racist country and not talking about the Declaration of Independence. Where did the founders think their rights came from? Well, they thought they came from God, so that means government can't take them away. There's about nothing that I say that angers the far left and the teachers' unions more than when I say, listen, we want to have an honest conversation with kids about the faith of our founders. We want them to understand, why did the founders say that? Why did they say that they believed our rights came from God? Well, where did that come from? What was their belief system that led them to that? Well, that's very important to understand how they created this government the way that they did. Well, the left has tried to completely secularize our education system in a way that really creates state-sponsored atheism. I mean, they drive any mention of God out of school. They threaten teachers who have a Bible verse on their desk or who say a prayer in a school. And so what they've been able to do is create state-sponsored atheism and driving this home. It's not historical. It's not historically accurate. That is not what our founders, when they talked about how to form this country, described what they were creating. And so it's so essential that we help our kids understand what made this country great, what the founders said they were doing, so that they can make the decisions to put this country back on that right track.
It is interesting that we see parents more and more, and there was sort of a great awakening, if you will, during the COVID pandemic of what was being taught by government-run schools here, Ryan. Talk a little bit about how parents are now looking for options. Is there an upswing in students who are registering in charter schools, homeschools, classical schools?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we saw during COVID is when schools shut down, when the unions forced schools to shut down, and then, you know, all of a sudden you had this online learning and you had parents going, hold on a second, wait, what was your teacher talking about right there? Wait, what's the materials they sent home with you? We began to see critical race theory. We began to see this radical gender theory in schools. And parents said, hey, listen, here's the deal. It's bad enough you shut the schools down when I'm having to still go to work. And so you put me in this terrible predicament with my own kid. But number two, what are you teaching my kid? And so parents started demanding, we've got to have more educational options and educational choices. We've got universal school choice here in the state of Oklahoma that we passed last year, and we've seen record enrollment. We have seen parents all over the state. We have charter schools popping up over the place, a lot of homeschool options. And in Oklahoma, we are very proud. I passed the first religious charter school in the country here in Oklahoma. It's being challenged by every left-wing group imaginable. But hey, the Catholics wanted to start a charter school. We said, absolutely, we want more options for kids. So we're proud to be the first state in the country to have a religious charter school. And we're just going to keep moving the ball forward. But you're seeing this all over the country. You hear President Trump talking about how he wants to bring school choice to every state, red state, blue state, through a universal national school choice plan, which I absolutely love. I think that is the key. We've got to unlock the potential of students in blue states too. And the way you do that is you get school choice done at the national level. And frankly, you abolish the Department of Education, who has been driving DEI, gender theory, Common Core before all of that. That agency has got to go, and President Trump has vowed to do that too. And so I couldn't be more supportive of his agenda. I think it's exactly what we need for this country.
Ryan Walters is Oklahoma State Superintendent. And Ryan, not every state has a state superintendent. Most states do have a Secretary of Education. Tell us a little bit about the difference and what does your position involve and how did you end up there?
We are one of 12 states that actually elect this office. So before I served in this role, I was actually our state Secretary of Education, which basically you're a policy advisor to the governor. And we place all of our power of education into this elected office. So I ran for this office. I went to all 77 counties, heard from parents all over the state, and we won on a reform agenda. And we have been blazing a blueprint across the state of what education reform can look like. We threw the teachers' unions out of school. We got school choice done. We have banned DEI programs. We have fought the unions to throw pornography out of our schools that we saw them pushing on our kids. And so we have led the country in this blueprint agenda of how you get education reform done, merit pay for teachers. We have been able to use free market principles like that to inject school choice, competition, and driving out radical leftists from our schools. And so I believe it's a blueprint for all states to follow. But, you know, it started with an election where we went around the state and I heard from parents who have conservative values, who said, listen, we're ready for our education system to be better, and we got to shake things up. And I said, absolutely. That's exactly what I heard all during the election. And so that's what I've been trying to do at lightning speed since taking office.
The power of the ballot box. Ryan Walters, Oklahoma State Superintendent. Ryan, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have been working our way through state-by-state primaries that have been taking place all across the country. This past week, the state of Georgia, a number of key races, including seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Scott Parkinson is going to talk about them. Scott, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back, Loman.
The 3rd Congressional District in Georgia, some really interesting electoral results there. Want to give us some background and let us know where that race stands?
In the 3rd Congressional District of Georgia, Drew Ferguson has been a member, I think, since the 2016 election. And Ferguson was a big ally of the leadership, rose his way into power, and was the chief deputy whip underneath Steve Scalise. But when Scalise ran for majority leader and Ferguson ran for the whip in the House, he lost that race. He actually took 3rd place. And so I think he kind of realized that his path to the leadership positions was closed off. And he ultimately decided not to seek re-election in 2024. And when Ferguson made that an open seat, it's one of the bright red districts of Georgia, a very safe Republican seat. So it's all about the primary and whether or not a candidate can reach 50% to avoid a runoff. Well, after Ferguson's retirement announcement, a bunch of people got in that race. Former state representative Philip Singleton, another former member in the state legislature named Mike Crane got in the race, and a state senator named Mike Dugan. And so Mike Dugan is a really, really strong candidate because he's a former state senator. But out of nowhere, not really out of nowhere, but right out of Mar-a-Lago, Brian Jack, who was from that congressional district, decided to get in the race. And Brian was political director for President Trump during the first administration and has been one of his closest aides, really, over the last few years. And when Brian got in the race, Donald Trump gave him his complete and total endorsement. And Club for Growth PAC also interviewed Brian and ultimately made an endorsement there as well. And what happened was Brian just got underneath 50%, but he was at about 48% on election night. And that means that we're headed to a runoff and he's going to face Dugan, who only got about 24% in the primary. But that primary runoff election is going to be June 18th.
We will continue to keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, back in Washington, D.C., Chuck Schumer is playing messaging games here, Scott, with illegal immigration, and most of the polls are showing illegal immigration along with inflation, the top concerns of voters. Both are hurting Joe Biden and Senate Democrat candidates all across the country. So now it appears that Chuck Schumer wants to try and paper this over. What is his play here?
Right now, Chuck Schumer is trying to gaslight the American people into saying that there's no illegal alien invasion, that there's no immigration crisis, that there's no crime wave caused by illegal aliens. They want to memory hole everything like Lake and Riley because the Democrats all voted against the Lake and Riley Act. They want to try to memory hole the fact that 10 million illegal aliens have come across the border just since Biden took the presidency. And the other thing that's important to understand here, there have been almost 1,000 people that have been on the terror watch list that have been apprehended on the southern border. And that's a heck of a number. How many actually have made it through without apprehension? In addition to that, how many were caught in Donald Trump's last year? Only 6. And so I think that it's a big, big national security issue. We've had over 30,000 Chinese illegal aliens come across the border. I think that China's sending them here to spy on us, steal intellectual property, and try to destroy our economy. The immigration invasion, no matter what Chuck Schumer says about it, it's a real, real problem. This is him piggybacking off the legislation that failed earlier this year, I think in early February or late January. And it's the same bill that was supposed to be a bipartisan bill that James Lankford from Oklahoma cut with the Democrats and Biden. And what the bill actually does is it provides for a legal status for every criminal alien that's come across the border and has been released from custody. Well, that's what catch and release is all about, right? And when you give somebody a legal status, that is amnesty. It also would allow for 5,000 illegal aliens to continue to come across the border every single day just before they have any border security enforcement utilized. And so I think that the American people are smart enough to look past the Democrats' BS and lying and gaslighting and instead investigate what's happening in their communities. Here in Virginia in Campbell County, we had a 32-year-old illegal alien that sexually assaulted and raped a 14-year-old girl. And these communities are deeply affected by this violent crime and things that are happening in their communities. It happens, obviously, in addition to illegal aliens with American citizens, but when it happens with somebody that came here illegally, they've tried to deport them, the ICE detainer requests aren't being honored by sanctuary cities and counties, I think that that creates a political crisis for the White House. And I think that that's why Joe Biden is leaning on Chuck Schumer to try to do more and say that they're actually the party of border security, when we know that they are the party of Biden's open border policies that make us less safe.
Well, I don't think the American public is going to be fooled by Chuck Schumer's maneuvering. We will keep an eye on that going forward with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we believe in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Visit clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Thank you, Scott. We'll check in again next week. Take care.
Thank you, Loman.
President Biden has gone to war against junk fees, but the federal government actually controls many such fees, and he could actually bring about change. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from the Cato Institute's Nick Anthony.
Under the Biden administration, the federal government has launched what the president is calling a war on junk fees, going after the extra fees that are charged by things like airlines and Ticketmaster when you buy, you know, concert tickets or sporting event tickets. They've also lumped credit card late fees into that. We've talked about that right here on this program just a few weeks ago, why capping those late fees is a mistake. We're going to take a little bit of a different approach today and look at some of the junk fees that government charges. You know, if the president wants to go after junk fees, this is probably the place he should start. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Nicholas Anthony. He is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. I think it's his first time on the show, so we welcome him here. And Nick, thanks for taking some time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
You have written a fantastic piece. Folks can find it at cato.org. It's on the Cato blog there, where you've uncovered 101 different late fees charged by the government. We unfortunately don't have time to go through all 101 here, but give us a sense of what's on that list.
Absolutely. Well, as you said, it's a list of 101 different late fees charged by the government, from the federal to state to local level, covering healthcare, taxes, fishing licenses, and everything in between. And it really showcases the hypocrisy right now with the Biden administration's quote unquote war on junk fees. They've said that late fees are one of the most costly and frequently applied junk fee, and yet they've been completely silent on all the fees that the government itself charges Americans. And just to be clear, this is 101 fees, but it is not all of the fees. This is not an exhaustive list. This is just what I put together over a couple days. It goes well beyond this.
I think some of the most tangible ones here and important ones, and I mentioned this in a piece I wrote about the credit card late fees, is what the IRS charges if you don't pay your taxes on time. I think that's 20% or something like that. And the reason they charge that is to incentivize you to pay your taxes on time, which is the same thing that the credit card companies are also trying to do.
Exactly. And that's why the hypocrisy here is just so painful to see. The government seems to understand that a late fee is to incentivize people to pay on time and to punish that late action, where you're effectively breaking a contract and you're able to settle the dispute right there with that fee. They seem to understand how that works when it comes to charging people, but when it comes to private businesses doing it, it somehow becomes a completely different story.
Can you pull out one or two here? Again, we unfortunately don't have time to check them all out, but pull out one or two here that, I don't know, made you slap your forehead when you uncovered it.
Oh, gosh. There are so many good ones. Okay, so I think just a couple of my favorites were, I was surprised to see at the local level how many incredibly specific late fees there are. For example, in the town of Southampton, there's a $75 late fee for a late mulch storage permit, for filing for a late permit to store mulch. And then over in Ohio, with the Ohio's EPA, there's a 10% fee for each week that a license renewal comes in late. So that's 10% per week. That really adds up fast.
We're talking with Nick Anthony. He is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and he's written a piece you can find at Cato's blog, 101 Late Fees Charged by the Government. Nick, I want to go back to a point you made earlier, just sort of underline this, because I think this is really the most important one, is that nobody likes paying late fees. You know, when I miss a credit card payment or something, I'm obviously not happy about it. But you said, you know, it's breaking a contract, and that's really sort of the crux of, at least on the credit card issue, that's a sort of agreement that people have made with a company that's lending them money. And so for the government to get involved in trying to kind of, you know, step in the middle of that mutually agreed to contract, I think just that it really rubs me the wrong way.
Oh, I'm right there with you. I'd much rather people have that fee. As bad as it might be, I don't enjoy it either, but I'd much rather pay that fee than have them completely shut down my account or call the police to get involved. I'd much rather settle it between ourselves and get it out of the way than have it blow up into something much bigger than it needs to be.
And when it comes to the Biden administration's war on junk fees, maybe they should start just by looking around their own house first.
Yes, I think some self-reflection is definitely in order.
Yeah, that is Nicholas Anthony from the Cato Institute. Nick, thanks for joining us. Great piece.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And again, you can find his work online at cato.org. They do lots of fantastic work in a variety of different policy areas. Of course, check out this piece, 101 Late Fees Charged by the Government. There's a long list there. You can scroll through them, find the ones that you may someday have to pay to your state government or local government, or perhaps even to the IRS, as we discussed. Again, that piece at cato.org. Check out our coverage of fiscal policy and everything going on in Washington, D.C. these days at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Social Security Trust Fund will ultimately not bring in enough money to cover benefit payments. But on this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA offers a few steps that can be taken to keep the fund solvent.
Recently, the Congressional Budget Office released an analysis of the Social Security Trust Fund, saying that it would run out of money in 9 years. The CBO then said that if nothing else were done, benefits would need to be cut by 20%. Can you imagine what a crisis that would be? So let's propose to solve it right here on American Radio Journal. We'll look at it first as a math problem, and only after we've understood the math will we look at it as a political problem. The fund is approaching insolvency because more dollars are flowing out as benefits than are flowing in as contributions. Therefore, to avoid insolvency, either fewer dollars must flow out or more dollars must flow in, or both. The CBO's announcement that a 20% benefit cut may be less than 10 years away may have been intended to shock people into taking the problem seriously, but it's not the only way to address the problem, and certainly not the best way. Under the current law, there is no Social Security tax paid on earnings above $168,600 a year, known as the earnings cap. It's a flat tax up to the cap, so that all wage earners up to that max pay the same rate, which is currently 6.2%. The employer pays the same amount, so the actual contribution to the Social Security Trust Fund is 12.4% of wages. Self-employed wage earners pay both the worker's 6.2 and the employer's 6.2. Flat taxes are, by definition, neither progressive nor regressive. Everyone pays the same rate. But above the earnings cap, the current system is regressive. Someone who earns twice the earnings cap pays a Social Security tax rate of only half of 6.2%, or 3.1%. as a matter of basic social equity, where's the morality in charging a tax rate of 6.2% to a wage earner of $168,000, but only 3.1% to a $337,000 earner? I'm generally not in favor of progressive tax rates, but I recognize the inequity of regressive ones, and the current Social Security tax is regressive. Simply staying with the current rate, but eliminating the wage cap would keep the system solvent until nearly 2060, according to an excellent econometric model from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a genuinely bipartisan public policy nonprofit. It can run various scenarios, and it's eye-opening to see which tweaks work and which don't. Making one additional small change, changing the annual cost of living annual adjustment to a different measure of consumer prices from the Bureau of Labor Statistics called chained CPI that many economists favor as more accurate. It would extend the solvency 50 years to 2074. That qualifies as a solution in my book. Now to the politics. The two changes suggested here are, in my opinion, the easiest to sell politically. Only the top 15% of earners would see any increase as a result of eliminating the earnings cap, and they would also see an increase in their retirement benefits. The cost of living formula change still yields a fair increase in benefits each year, resulting from inflation. Wage earners under $170,000 would see no increase, and should be easily persuaded to support the elimination of the earnings cap if it could save Social Security from imminent insolvency. There are other proposals that would also achieve long-term solvency. The mass majority propose fixes that raise the retirement age or raise the Social Security tax rate or both, but those are almost certainly more difficult to pass through Congress, and neither one is necessary. One key political question is whether there's a greater political benefit for fixing the Social Security solvency crisis than there is a political cost to supporting these two tweaks. I believe that there is. President Biden has famously said that he wouldn't raise taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000. This proposal would violate that pledge, but not by much. The highest increase would be paid by someone making just under $400,000, and that increase would be less than $1,500. That's a pretty small cost to ensure that Social Security is there for them when they're eligible, especially if it also increased their payouts. Democrats often support shifting more of any tax burden to the wealthiest taxpayers, so this modest but effective reform should garner easy support from Democrats. Republicans often oppose tax progressivity, and this plan can be sold to them as a flat tax, which it is. If the Congress can be persuaded that solving a major problem brings more political benefits than kicking the proverbial can down the road, then it should be doable. Remember, you heard it first here. This has been Colin Hanna for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KKBG-FM in Hilo, Hawaii, KLEO-FM in Kahalu, Kona, Hawaii, and KWJZ-FM in Snohomish, Washington. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.